From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And from Third Dynasty came the great multi-genius Imhotep, the real father of medicine, who lived 1,800 years before the Greek who's called the father of medicine. And when we read the biography of the Greek, he says, I am a child of Imhotep. And from the 18th Dynasty came the world's great social reformer and
John Henry Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk, part two of the documentary of the life of the great African-American historian. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel and the Palestinians reached a deal on the next stage of Middle East peace today after all-night talks at a marathon summit in Maryland. This according to Israeli, Palestinian, and U.S. officials. Palestinian negotiators were first to announce the agreement, which came on the ninth day of roller coaster talks in rural Maryland between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Among the critical issues resolved in the early hours of Friday were the release of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails, amending the Palestinian charter, and a package of security measures sought by Israel. The New York Times is reporting that U.S. intelligence officials received a detailed warning that, quote, Islamic radicals were planning to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nairobi 9 months before the building was attacked. The State Department has maintained that it received no specific warnings about threats to its embassies in East Africa, this again according to the report. But late yesterday, a spokesperson acknowledged that the CIA had sent the State Department two reports which prompted the embassy in Kenya to step up security for several weeks. According to the report, when no attack occurred, the embassy's precautions turned to normal. Additional measures were not taken to improve the building's physical security. The New York City Council petitioned by human rights groups to follow the example of Chilean ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet's arrest voted yesterday to ask the U.S. government to deport Haitian Death Squad leader Emmanuel Toto Constant. The resolution calls on Washington to honor the request of the Haitian government to return Constant from New York to Port-au-Prince to stand trial for crimes during military rule in Haiti. Constant has been allowed to live in New York in the borough of Queens. Many believe that the U.S. government has allowed him to do that because they don't want him to spill the beans on the U.S. role in the coup in Haiti. The Nation magazine exposed that Emmanuel Constant was on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. The political opponent of a Tennessee state senator who was shot to death this week was arrested today and charged with murder. The state's district attorney told the NBC Today show that Byron Lotax Looper was charged with first-degree murder in the death of Senator Tommy Burks. He said Looper was arrested outside his house, which police were staking out early this morning. He was arrested without incident. This news from Chicago, fast food giant Wendy's is facing a $150 million lawsuit from an African-American franchise owner who says the company discriminates. The man who owns three Wendy's franchises in Houston says racism is Wendy's dirty little secret. He says the company forces black franchises to build restaurants from scratch and take an enormous debt, but sells corporate-owned restaurants to whites for far less. Other franchise owners at the company's convention in Chicago agree with the man's claims and are calling for a Wendy's boycott. They say the hamburger chain doesn't have any black franchise owners in many major metropolitan areas and none in California. Hundreds of Anheuser-Busch workers are refusing to cross the picket line in St. Louis and return to their jobs at a plant there after a few dozen Teamsters went on strike. Members of Teamsters Local 367 walked out yesterday in the first strike at an Anheuser-Busch plant since 1976. While no other unions are striking, the other 1,800 Teamsters at the plant honored the picket lines and left the plant, as did workers from other unions, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, and others. The union and the world's largest brewer have been at odds since contract talks began more than a year ago, mostly over concerns over job security issues. Last month, the brewery broke off talks, and yesterday, Anheuser-Busch officials said they would not alter their final offer. and a march protesting police brutality in New York. Yesterday, hours after marchers gained approval from a federal judge after a permit battle between activists and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, the march was one of more than 50 similar protests against police brutality in cities across the nation organized by the October 22nd coalition. And this news from California, police arrested 8 members of the environmental group Greenpeace yesterday, 3 days after they chained themselves to a Canadian freighter in Long Beach to protest logging in British Columbia. But other members of Greenpeace vowed to stop the freighter from offloading its cargo of newsprint that they claim was made from trees in a British Columbia rainforest. That's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And as news comes and goes, there's some news that is timeless. Not really news, but history and context. And today we continue in our look at the life of John Henrik Clark, the African-American historian. John Henrik Clark, an Alabama sharecropper's son, whose thirst for unfettered knowledge led him to top a freight train to New York and transform himself into an African history scholar who helped spur the development of black studies and who spent 6 decades as a gadfly fixture in the intellectual life of Harlem. He died in July in Harlem. He was 83 years old. Today, we honor his life with a documentary that's been executive produced by Wesley Snipes, narrated by him as well, directed by St. Clair Bourne. It's called John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk. This is part 2.
I was drafted to the Army in September 1941. I can say with certainty I was probably one of the best clerks, one of the worst soldiers the Army ever had. I couldn't shoot, didn't like the hot sun, didn't like to go on those all-night trips, but I was a wizard of administration. I made sure my men got what was due to them as soldiers and men. Not as black men, but as soldiers and men. After I returned from the Army, it was not so much as finding myself again as a Pan-Africanist, but redefining myself as a Pan-Africanist. Remember, we had participated in a war that we were cynical about in the first place, and having participated in this war on a Jim Crow basis, getting out of the war, and there wasn't the employment that we had hoped would be there, I began to think more and more about the fact that African people would have to depend on themselves.
Pan-Africanism would be perceived as a way to end African dependence on colonial masters, a way to create free and independent nations, a way to transfer the continent's immense riches from the hands of invaders into those of the indigenous people of the land.
I began to define Pan-Africanism as the building of an African world community, the union of African people in different parts of the world, the African population in India and the Pacific Islands, the African population in the Caribbean and Brazil and South America. And I was looking to the fact that we number 1 billion people on the face of the earth. If you put them all together and they did one thing in unison, even if it was wrong, it might alter the world. Africa has always been and still is the world's richest continent. Africa has always had things other people wanted, thought they couldn't do without, and didn't want to pay for. So therefore, there's always been an excuse to invade Africa. Alexander's invasion was the first purely European invasion of Africa. Everything that had happened in Egypt and in Africa before 332 BC was something that no European had anything to do with. Now we see the beginning of European occupation, and we see it as aggression, not bringing civilization, but destroying civilizations that it did not understand.
The uninvited arrival of European armies in the Upper Nile Valley signals the beginning of the end for the highest civilization the world had known. The conquerors, quite literally, changed the complexion of the conquered.
Now you're beginning to get a mulatticized population that a whole lot of people keep misinterpreting as white. With each one of these invaders came the bastardization of the population based on the fact that for the sake of pleasure, the foreign soldier heads for the female population at a time the male population has been defeated in war. The Greeks' rule didn't last that long before they were challenged. An ambitious and well-dressed bunch of thugs across the ocean, not very educated, but they could fight like hell, called Romans, began to have ambition for the trade in the Mediterranean.
Carthage, a powerful black state in North Africa, had imperial ambitions of its own. By the 3rd century BC, its forces had crossed the Mediterranean and established a large province in Spain. The military commander of Carthage had apprehensions about his Roman neighbors and warned his son to keep a watchful eye.
Hannibal's father, he would point across the ocean and said, there's some evil people over there. We better bring the war to them before they bring it to us. Hannibal never forget.
Hannibal is only 26 when he takes charge of the army. He launches an audacious military adventure, leading his men and their elephants over the Pyrenees Mountains into France, then pointing them across the Alps, boldly, toward Rome itself. Heavy casualties, overextended supply lines, and defection of allies drive Hannibal off the soil of southern Europe. He retreats back home to Carthage.
The Romans have made a mission, almost a cult, out of the destruction of Carthage. They would meet each other in the morning. Good morning, Roman citizen. Carthage must be destroyed. Yes, of course, Roman citizen, Carthage must be destroyed.
Rome's legions clash with Hannibal near Zama. His troops are defeated. Hannibal is sent into exile. His once mighty nation becomes another colony of Rome and an administrative center for their empire.
Now, the Roman Empire internally was not very rich. Africa became the breadbasket for the Roman Empire. And except for Africa, the Roman Empire would not have been able to sustain itself. Now, the Roman presence in North Africa is going to force into being one of the great events in human history. Roman taxation, Roman oppression would cause people to turn to new gods and question old gods, to turn to a story about a god who comes forth to rescue them. Now, they would draw from African folklore the story of the child in the manger. Now, what am I saying? Later, in retrospect, he was referred to as Jesus Christ. Now, you can argue about the coloration of Christ if you want to, but I can sell that very quick and we can go on to the next subject. Was he a Roman? The answer is no. Was he a Greek? The answer is still no. He was the only European types in that part of the world at the time. If he was neither Roman or Greek, he was one of those other people. And all of those other people were non-European and non-white. And he came from the other people.
During that time of Roman dominance, Africans hold high military and administrative posts in the empire.
The Romans and the Greeks had no color prejudice comparable to the kind of prejudice we would know later on. Otherwise, why would three Africans become emperors of Rome? Why would there be three African popes? Finally, Constantine decided to make Christianity the religion of the whole of the Roman Empire. Now we're coming to the critical period when the Roman domination of the church so corrupted the church, the Africans began some disenchantment with the Roman interpretation of Christianity. Constantine calls a council of bishops and priests at a place called Nice. It's the Nicene Conference. It is at this conference that the European created a European concept of Christianity. It was at this conference that they began to take the African saints out of the literature of Christianity. Now the corruption had started. The physical concept of Jesus Christ did not exist. Now, how did it come into existence? Because the Pope commissioned it to come into existence. Michelangelo painted the picture using one of his relatives as model, and that picture, one of the finest pieces of propaganda ever projected in history, has changed the minds of millions of people as who's supposed to represent God, whoever he or she is, and I have no problem with the she. Spirituality is a way of accepting the fact that there is a spiritual force in the universe larger than all of mankind. But someone had to come along and invent a word called God. Then someone had to say of another God and say, mine is better than yours. Then someone had to create faith. Someone said, I have the true faith. Religion is the organization of spirituality into something that became the handmaiden of conquerors. Nearly all religions were brought to people and imposed on people by conquerors and used as the framework to control their mind. My main point here is that if you are the child of God and God is a part of you, then in your imagination, God's supposed to look like you. And when you accept a picture of the deity assigned to you by another people, you become the spiritual prisoners of that other people.
You're listening to John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk. This is an excerpt of a video documentary directed by St. Clair Bourne, the award-winning filmmaker. It's also executive produced by Wesley Snipes. He narrates the documentary as well. We'll be back with it on this special today on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue today with the excerpt of the documentary John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk, John Henrik Clark, the African-American historian, teacher, lecturer, writer, has written numerous books, his emphasis, African history. This is a documentary that is executive produced by Wesley Snipes. He narrates the documentary as well. St. Clair Bourne is its director. It is called John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk.
Many Africans became Roman citizens, just like many black Americans today. I have nothing to do with Africa. I'm an American. I'm a citizen. I'm an American. There were Africans way back there with that same kind of split personality silliness, not knowing where their ethnic identity belonged.
Rome's hold over its far-flung provinces weakens. In North Africa, it faces a new and fierce challenge, Islam.
The Arabs, noticing the weakness of the Romans in North Africa, began to court the favor of the Africans.
Arabs convinced the local black populations to join in the struggle against a common oppressor. They also convinced many of them to abandon their traditional beliefs and pledge their allegiance to Allah.
The Africans assumed that by supporting the Arabs would get the Romans literally off their back. They were right. The Arabs did get the Romans off their back, but the Arabs replaced the Romans on their back. And like most conquerors, they declared war on African culture and African ways of life. The Arab has always been a propagator and a defender of slavery. They've always rationalized slavery based on Islam. I do not think any religion sanctions slavery. And any time you use a religion to sanction slavery, you're misusing that religion and misusing the word of God. Well, the Christians did it, and the Arabs have done it, and the Hebrews have done it. It's not right in any case.
Islamic armies, their ranks dominated by African converts, defeat the Romans and push on to the continent of Europe. In the process, they capture Spain. There, the Africans and Arabs create a rich, cultured, and powerful empire. So powerful, it endures for 500 years.
The achievement of the Arabs at this time is they have driven the Europeans out of the Mediterranean. The European now must go back into Europe. They have no empires, no great connections outside of Europe. And because of this, they ultimately would go into a period called the Dark Ages. People are confused because when the European mentioned the Dark Ages, for him were not the Dark Ages for other people. Concurrent with his Dark Ages, the African had his third golden age.
As Europe suffers, three great kingdoms are emerging in West Africa: Mele, or Mali, Ghana, and Songhai. These were lands of enormous wealth, generated by their control of the trade routes across the Sahara and the abundance of their gold mines. The kingdoms were known for their benevolent governments and their great respect for learning.
For a while in history, there were only two great universities: the University of Sankore at Timbuktu and the University of Salamanca in Spain. And the African was solely in charge of the one at Sankore and partly in charge of the one at Salamanca.
The Arabs, had to some degree institutionalized the practice of African slavery. The Europeans internationalized it. In Europe, the wealth amassed from the slave trade makes the Industrial Revolution possible, while laying the foundations of modern capitalism. In the Americas, the traffic in human souls creates a vast African diaspora, millions upon millions of people ripped from their homelands, transported in chains to a distant, hostile world.
The European came into Africa as a guest and was treated as a guest. The Africans unsuspected, political, naive, as some of them still are, because he had nothing against the Europeans and he had never enslaved any Europeans. He just assumed automatically no European would enslave him. He had never dealt with anyone who would enslave the host and the wife who cooked the meal and lie about it. Around 1442, the first slaves would be taken out of West Africa. Spain and Portugal goes to the Pope, the leading arbitrator of that day, the one person in Europe with the greatest authority. The Pope would say to Spain and Portugal, you take the East and you take the West, and you two good Catholic nations start fighting among yourselves. And then the profound statement before departure, you are both authorized to reduce to servitude all infidel people. The slave trade now had been sanctioned, and Europeans had been told they need not feel guilty of it because you're doing this to an infidel who is outside of God's grace. England went into the slave trade with a vengeance, led by Captain Hawkins and the good ship Jesus. The ship was called the Good Ship Jesus. The coat of arms on the ship was two Africans bound back to back with their arms tied. So they saw no contradiction in being in the slave trade and being Christians at the same time. We cannot deal with this enough because we're still suffering from this inside of the mind of a lot of people in this world, into the millions. We are outside of humanity, outside of the grace of God. That's a terrible feeling as you walk the earth, because what has been taken away is your essential humanity, your human beingness. And when they take away your human beingness, they take away your nationness. Early in the 19th century, the concept of slavery began to yield to the concept of colonialism, a more sophisticated form of slavery. Slavery as a system became unwieldy, and besides, there's a point where it was saturated. Everybody who wanted a slave had one, who could afford one. The European nations of size that did not have any portion of Africa began to grumble. At the Berlin Conference, 1884 and 1885, the European powers of substance who did not have any part of Africa now were given some parts.
Africans did not fall at the feet of the European invaders. They fought fiercely, bravely, and continually.
Anti-colonial wars started up down the coast of West Africa, in parts of inner Africa and in the Congo. There was armed resistance. The Zulu Wars lasted from the 1650s when the Boers arrived until the last Zulu War was 1906. In Ghana, the Ashanti Wars lasted from early in the 18th century until the last Ashantiwa, led by a woman, Ye Asantewa, in 1900. For a while, it looked as though the Europeans would not be able to hold on to the continent. More manpower and more ruthless treatment brought it mainly under their control. By 1884, 1885, and afterward, there wasn't no dispute about who was in charge of Africa, just who was in charge of what part of it. We have been hung up with a myth, the myth of the conqueror and the invader as the bringer of civilization. No people ever brought civilization to another people at no time and at no place in history. It's one of the most protracted lies we ever listened to. Civilization is the art of being civil. The word civil means being peaceful. And there's nothing peaceful about aggression. Only the slave can abolish slavery. If someone is on your back, you have to bend a little to balance them on your back. Now, the best move, if you want to get them off of your back, is to stand straight up. There's something about an island, a body of water, it creates a special kind of dreamer, because they did not know where they came from in Africa. They dreamed of the whole of it, bring it all together in one piece.
The seeds of Pan-Africanism, planted in the United States during slavery years, later flourish in the fertile soil of the British West Indies.
Trinidad produced the three greatest Pan-Africanists: H. Sylvester Williams, C.L.R. James, and George Padmore. In Trinidad, they found the Pan-African League. H. Sylvester Williams would eventually call it Pan-African. He would call a conference in London in 1900. A few scattered Africans, a few people from the Caribbean, W. Du Bois from the United States. They did not ask for the independence of African states then. They asked for preparation. Give us the kind of education that will prepare us for eventual independence. They were reasonable, but they weren't listened to. And yet the conference made some kind of impression. After the first Congress, Du Bois would be the leading light from the second through four, but the most meaningful, the one that Du Bois called in Paris. As a result of this Congress, Du Bois came to center stage as the leader and theoretician of Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanism wasn't exactly new, because Black Americans were practicing it long before someone gave it a name. The African settlement movement, the movement that settled Liberia, was informed of Pan-African movement. The so-called Negro Convention movement was most a discussion of how you bring the African world together. That whole 19th century was Pan-African thought. Prince Hall, his development of the Black Masonic Order that he called the African Lodge, the search for a place in Africa for settlement by Martin Delaney and Robert Campbell. 1829, David Walker's appeal to the colored people of the world was basically a Pan-African appeal. All of this before we come down to the end of the 19th century. The ultimate Pan-Africanist, of course, was the Jamaican Marcus Garvey.
Citizens of Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Improvement Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million Negroes of the world.
It was soon after the end of World War I Secretary of War had told the black American soldiers that their lot would not be appreciably changed by virtue of the fact that they fought in the war. There had been an investigation. It was discovered that many of the nurses wouldn't treat black soldiers in the hospital, wouldn't even touch them. Some of them died as a result. So you have these grievances pent up in the veteran coming home. All of this came to a head in 1919 when there were riots all over the United States. That's called the Red Summer. Marcus Garvey could point out, look, they don't want you here. Let's go back home. Let's go to Africa. Go back to Africa. Let's not only go back to Africa, let's go back in our own ships. Now, a whole lot of people who otherwise would not listen, now willing to listen.
We hear the cry of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Japan for the Japanese. We of the Universal Negro Movement Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad.
He began to dream the great dream and rescue the mind of millions of black Americans from depression and self-doubt. By 1923, he was in some difficulty with the boats and some of the people he had hired to run the boats. Terrible mismanagement and betrayal. He collected millions of dollars from black Americans to buy these boats, and these boats were old and not as seaworthy as he thought they were. Garvey moved over large territory, maybe too fast, and yet he built the largest movement in black America before or since. That needs to be a reassessment of Marcus Garvey and his long-reaching effects. He called attention to what slavery and colonialism had taken away. They took away a concept essential to all the people in the world. They took away the concept of state management and state maintenance. Once you are taken from the geography of your origin and forced to live in a state designed by others, you're still the slave to the man who's astute enough to control a container called the state.
The cannons of World War II were barely cold when Africans met in Manchester, England. They were prepared to claim that container called the state for themselves.
The Pan-African Congress of 1945, now you have the one thing you did not have in the rest of them. You have Caribbean scholars, African-American scholars, not a whole lot, and Africans themselves are now participating. We're not talking about Africa out of the presence of Africa. Now you're talking about Africans with the Africans on the scene. One African being the co-convener of the conference, Kwame Nkrumah. Out of that fifth Pan-African Congress came the mentality, the basic planning to rule and to take over a nation. The others were saying, give us the education. At the fifth Pan-African Congress, they said, we got the education, we got the manpower, we want to rule now.
The people of Ghana resisted British rule from the very beginning. In March of 1957, they become the first Africans to win their freedom. Kwame Nkrumah was ready to rule.
When I knew Nkrumah in the Harlem History Club days, my impression of him was not as a future head of state, but as an African who's going to go back and make a major contribution to his nation, and he was a committed African.
You're listening to excerpt of the documentary John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk. It's directed by St. Clair Bourne. It is executive produced and narrated by Wesley Snipes. We'll be back with it here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute.
Old pirates, yes, they rock. rabbi sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we bring you this final segment of the documentary, video documentary on the life of John Henrik Clark, called John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk. It's directed by St. Clair Bourne. It is executive produced by Wesley Snipes. He also narrates the documentary. John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk.
I went to Africa 1958 because I was promising myself I was going to get to Africa next year.
These songs of freedom, 'cause all I ever had, redemption songs.
One of my stories in an African magazine and wrote and got my address. I said I was coming to Ghana, get me a place in a hotel for a few days. And he didn't even go to a hotel, even try. He took me to the slums of Accra, and I lived right there with him. Finally, a check that was due me from America did not arrive. When it did arrive, it bounced. So, there I was, and one day, Nkrumah had gone someplace. He's coming home from a visit of state. A whole lot of people along the highway hailing his return. And so I was along with the rest of them. I was just like another African, melting into the crowd. And he spotted me, and they stopped the Rolls Royce, and the motorcycle drivers pulled their guns, thought that someone was about to hurt the president, you know. His motorcade stopped, and he came out, and see, what the hell are you doing in my country? And I just laughed. You see, you're a long way from Harlem. He looked right and said, where do you live? I said, in Jamestown. Jamestown is the slums of Accra. Still is. He shook his head and said, you sure must love Africa. Finally, he headed back to his car, and he turned back to me. He said, you know what I'm going to do for you? I told him I didn't have any job, and my check had bounced. I didn't even know how I was going to get home. Said, I'm going to put your Harlem behind to work. And he gave me a job. Working on his newspaper, the Evening News. The significance of Ghana independence at that time is that it gave spirit to the whole of the African world. It was a major impact on Black America because it came at the time the civil rights movement was reaching a crescendo, a great height. His first vision of Pan-Africanism was the physical unification of Africa. And he said that gun and freedom won't mean anything until the rest of Africa is free. So the spirit of Ghanaian independence would create a light of hope in the rest of Africa. And this is what Kwame Nkrumah was trying to build. This is what the intelligence services of the United States, England, and France had to destroy to keep the example of Ghana from emerging. What went wrong was our misunderstanding of what a state consists of in the responsibility that goes into holding one together. And our dependence on our colonial masters more than we anticipated. We who had longed so much for power, We wanted power, power. When we got close enough to touch it, we realized we hadn't even decided what we're going to do with it once we get it.
Now, I want to take this opportunity to welcome again to the United States, which he knows so well, the first citizen of Ghana, President Nkrumah.
I was in the anti-poverty program in Harlem, and when Nkrumah came and spoke at the United Nations, I got the picture and showed it to them, and I got the speech. And the first thing I showed them, I said, look, there's a black man, head of a nation, speaking to the world. He got coarse, nappy hair. He didn't apologize for it. He said, here I am, African and black and bold and powerful and head of a nation, and I got something to say to you, and this is what I got to say. Resistance of Gandhi, and we should understand this, was a strategy.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I received the inspiration to carry on in the nonviolent tradition from Jesus of Nazareth and the operational technique from Mahatma Gandhi.
The passive resistance of the civil rights movement was sold as a way of life. A strategy is never a way of life. A strategy is something you use the same as you use an orange. When the juice is gone, you throw it in the garbage can. And Mahatma Gandhi was an East Indian nationalist, but a very skillful politician, and he always had a violent alternative waiting in the wing just in case his nonviolence didn't work.
Today marks the beginning of a determined, organized, mobilized campaign to get the right to vote all over this state.
I think Dr. Martin Luther King was the spiritual leader of the black movement, of the civil rights movement, and probably one of the finest theologians that we produced in recent years. He was a dreamer, and yet he was a committed man to struggle, and he made great sacrifice within that struggle. I had some strong disagreements with him. I never thought that we should be locked into the concept of nonviolence as a way of life. I was perfectly willing to use it as a strategy. I think we should be slow in criticizing Martin Luther King. He was brave enough to put his life on the line for what he believed. We are still here talking. That's proof enough of his bravery over ours. I think the march on Washington was just that. It wasn't a march on Washington, it was a march in Washington. I don't know of any sweeping achievements that came out of it. It was a great ceremony. I'd be hard-pressed to identify the substance. I happen to think we've gotten enough mileage out of marching. It was a great ceremony. It was a great rehearsal for a show we did not put on the road. For a time, we had the attention of the world. Between the Civil Rights Movement, the Caribbean Federation Movement, and the African Independence Movement, we had the attention of the world, and there were people, though they hated our guts, they were willing to make concessions to us based on the fact that we were ready to handle power. We made too many speeches and didn't do the necessary work, the unglamorous off-camera work that would have made it possible. That was our great mistake. Ceremony that lacked substance. And that was a voice loud and clear and analytical. We were fighting to keep from hearing that voice. It was the voice of Big Bad Malcolm X, who had both the national and the international message.
One of the reasons that it is bad for us to continue to just refer to ourselves as so-called Negro, that's negative. When we say so-called Negro, that's pointing out what we aren't, but it isn't telling us what we are. We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America.
I met him first in 1958. I know him from that period until his death, and sometimes saw him on a daily basis. I would furnish information on history and background information. I never told Malcolm X what to do, and I don't remember anybody else who told him what to do either.
They have studied the tactics and the strategy and the methods of all of the African nations who have emerged and won their independence. And they've seen that the Africans didn't get it by sitting in. They didn't get it by waiting in. They didn't get it by singing We Shall Overcome. They got it through nationalism.
I first met Malcolm at the World's Trade Show building. Looked me up and down and said, I bet you're a swine eater. I'll admit that I had paid some joyful visits to pork chops and other parts of the pig. And I said that, you know, Malcolm, if it wasn't for the pig, you and I wouldn't be here arguing about the pig, because some of us would be gone. We would have starved to death. Many times when Malcolm X was prefacing his speeches with the words the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, Malcolm X was teaching Malcolm X lessons over and beyond anything the Honorable Elijah Muhammad ever thought about.
You say we are on the road now to a better world because the white man promised integration. This is a disgrace.
Mr. Muhammad's analysis is that until the image of the black man in the mind of the black man has been changed, you will always have delinquency, parental as well as juvenile. So his entire approach is not so much to change the attitude of the white man toward the black man, but to change the attitude of the black man about himself.
The Arabs and certain powerful groups within Islam really wanted Malcolm on their side. There was a serious attempt to persuade Malcolm to turn on Elijah Muhammad and establish a second Islamic group based on what they consider to be orthodox Islam. They offered him $3.5 million. He turned it down, and we were walking down the street toward his car, and this man had turned down $3.5 million, and whacked me on the shoulder, says, swine eater, let me buy you a cup of coffee. He was more loyal to Elijah Muhammad than Elijah Muhammad eventually was to him. Elijah Muhammad was getting old and feeble, and there was suspicion that Malcolm X would be the logical successor. There were those within the nation who didn't want Malcolm X as the logical successor because Malcolm X would have done some serious house cleaning. He was an honest man, and there were some thieves in the house. I think his development as a Pan-Africanist came a little later in his life. In the final analysis, he was as good a Pan-Africanist as any of the rest.
We have to have the type of understanding of Africa and the type of understanding of our people here in order to build a bridge, a contact, a line of communication between the two. And once the lines of communication have been established, and our African brothers can stretch forth their hands and reach us, and we can stretch forth our hands and reach them, why, there's nothing that this blue-eyed man in this country will be able to do to you and me successfully from that day onward.
Malcolm X had laid down a threat to the colonial powers of the world.
It is nationalism that's bringing freedom to oppressed people all over the world. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Algerians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Nigerians and to the Ghanaians.
I do not think Malcolm X's murder was a local American thing. I think it was a larger thing than that. I do not think that Farrakhan had anything directly to do with the murder, but I do think Farrakhan is guilty of creating the attitude and the atmosphere that led to the murder. Without Farrakhan, Malcolm X, I think, still would have been assassinated. We were friends from the day we met.
John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk. This is a documentary directed by St. Clair Bourne, executive produced and narrated by Wesley Snipes. And I thank you very much for listening to Democracy Now! Today. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Maria Carrion. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. Our webmaster is Michelle Garcia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Hot Talk from Cal Poly. I'm Saul Landau, and we're broadcasting here from the studios of California State.